Lecture. So I want a few words about yesterday's lecture, because I kind of forgot to I applied through the maths and forgot to mention the context. It's a classic mistake. So in the 60s, Gell-Mann and Neumann built up this eightfold way to describe flavor, SU3 flavor, and the different how hadrons fit into different multiplets of SU3 flavor. I think Mike Peskin probably taught you some stuff about that. But people realized that in each multiplet of SU3 flavor, they only had the same spin. All the particles had the same spin. So you had the mesons, they were all spin zero mesons in one multiplet, and so on. And so people wondered why that was the case. And then in 1967, there was this famous Kolmogorov-Mandula theorem. So there they were considering what symmetries of the S matrix you can have in general and still have non-trivial scattering. And they proved, they had an implicit assumption they assumed bosonic symmetry generators because that's really all people had thought about in particle physics, at least back then. And they showed that the most general symmetry of an S matrix is the Poincaré symmetry. And still have, some interactions, is a direct product of Poincaré with some internal symmetry. And if you try and impose anything else on it, you get zero scattering. Okay. So what this means is, a consequence of this is that in every multiplet of some internal symmetry, you're going to have particles of the same spin, because it's the Poincaré symmetry that changes the spins. And so there's no more general symmetry that you can invent where you kind of mix these up in some non-trivial way. So in other words, you simultaneously, if you change the color, then that necessarily implies a boost or some like weird thing like that where it's mixed up. And of course, we've extended this by adding fermionic symmetry generators, the Q and Q bar. So Susie gets around Kolmogorov-Mandula. With the fermionic generators. Q and Q bar. Grassmann, they have this anti-commutation relation. So what we're going to do this lecture is review states, the representations of the Poincaré symmetry, okay, briefly, and then we'll show what happens when you go to the super Poincaré symmetry to the representations and add these Q and Q bars in. We'll be able to build up some super multiplets, they're called. So these will be multiplets of particles which contain different spin. Okay. All right, so let's remind ourselves and perhaps, I don't know, this is the first time you've seen this. So remind ourselves about Poincaré representations. So first recall the rotations group. Group of rotations in 3D space. So you can describe this with SO3. Locally that's the same as SU2. The algebra is the same. So we have our SU2 relation. okay, which is very familiar by now. And, okay, so IJK go from 1 to 3, as we know. And we have a Casimir of this group, which, so Casimir is an operator which commutes with all symmetry generators. And our Casimir of this rotations group is J squared, which is just the sum of J1 squared plus J2 squared plus J3 squared. And as you know, when you act on a state with this thing, you get eigenvalues you get h bars times, which I've set to 1, times some natural number times the natural number plus 1. J times j plus 1, where j is half integer. So j is 0, half, 1, etc. Okay, and that's just, of course, the overall spin of the multiplet. And if j is a half, it's a fermion. And if it's integer, then it's a boson. And then, so these the eigenvalues of the Casimirs label the irreducible representation you're talking about. And then within that irreducible representation, there are states. And here for the rotation group, so J labels the representation, the irreducible representation. And within each, the J3 eigenvalue labels each element. So, you know, if you want an analogy, in SU3, the fact that it's a 3 labels the representation, and then within each, the elements are distinguished by the colors. So you could say red, green, blue distinguishes the elements. So each state, J3, of course, as you know from quantum mechanics, goes from minus j in integer steps up to plus j. So each irreducible representation has 2 j plus 1 elements within it. And so we label the states with the irreducible representation label and the element label. So, but what we're going to do is copy this procedure for Poincaré representations. We're going to find some Casimirs of the Poincaré group. And we're going to use those as labels for the irreducible representation. And then find some observables which label the elements of the irreducible representation. So in the Poincaré group, we have 2 Casimirs, Casimir operators, C1 is P mu, P mu, and C2 is W mu, where W mu is defined like this. In terms of Lorentz group operators and momentum, four momentum operators. And it's called the Pauli-Lubyansky vector. Now, I'm probably going to spell this wrong. I'm certainly pronouncing it wrong. Lubyansky. And really, this defines some notion, so a kind of generalized spin, sort of spin. Okay, so the eigenvalue of C1 acting on a state. So these capital P's are operators, okay? Oops. And so is the W at this stage. And the eigenvalues of C1 when you act on a state with it are rest mass squared of the state. Yep.
Is there a general procedure for finding how many Casimir operators you have from the algebra? Or do you kind of have to guess?
No, there is a procedure.
It's the same as the rank, isn't it?
It is. It's the rank of the group. So you know how many you've got to get. There must be a procedure.
I think
there is. You don't think there is?
I'm pretty feeling not. No.
Okay. Well, of course, you can have linear combinations of them, of Casimirs is also Casimir.
But I'm not entirely sure there's a...
Okay. Well, yeah. Okay, that's interesting. I don't know.
Yeah, I think you have to be a bit inspired.
Well, if you know an upper... How do you find the upper limit on the number of Casimirs? It's just it's the rank, right? I assume. Okay. Yeah. So the eigenvalues of C1 are m squared, and we're just going to call the eigenvalues of C2, we're going to call them omega, or little w. Let's call them little omega. Okay. And so we label our irreducible representation, or the multiplet, by those two observables. But we need some extra labels to find the states within each irreducible representation. And actually, the eigenvalue of P mu gives us one, so the four momentum. So I'll call the eigenvalue little p mu without a stick. That's the labels. So far, we've got. So in other words, you know, P mu acting on M and W. So what I'll do is I'll put a semicolon there to distinguish between observables, eigenvalues, which label the multiplet, and the other ones which labels the elements in the multiplet. And that one will be little p mu. That's still not enough. We need one more. So consider an example. A massive particle. So let's have the eigenvalues of the p mu operator as this. So we're just sitting in the rest frame of the particle, so it has some mass. So now there's this SO3 rotational symmetry. We can rotate the particle around in three dimensions, and nothing changes with this p mu. And so we know that we can use the rotation observables to label the state. J will label the representation, and J3 will label the state within that, the element of the representation. So let's just look at what the Pauli-Lubyansky vector looks like. So you now substitute in this p mu for this operator. Okay, well, you can imagine acting on a state with it, and then you get back the eigenvalue. You must bear in mind that epsilon, in these conventions, we have epsilon 0, 1, 2, 3 is minus epsilon 0, 1, 2, 3 with indices upstairs is plus 1. Okay. And so substituting for p mu, and you'll find, it's a short exercise, that you'll find that W0 is 0 and WI is minus M times JI. And the reason that you get that is because the MIJs times a three-dimensional epsilon tensor are equal to the JIs from a couple of lectures ago. Okay, so you can see that you're going to get the only non-zero p mu is the p zero here. So you've got zero nu rho sigma, and this epsilon tensor is zero unless all of these things are not equal to zero. So you can write it as ijk. Where I, J, and K go from 1 to 3, and then you'll get out these two relations. So we see that actually for this representation, the three components of this Pauli-Lubyansky tensor vector are the rotation, three-dimensional rotation operators. Okay, so we don't have to use, instead of this omega, we can just use J, we can just use the spin. Yep.
For the definition of W, you have a three index on the left, so you want three index on the right.
I'm sorry?
The three index on the left.
Ah, okay, yeah, sorry, that should be a new. Thank you. Thank you. Yeah, that would screw everything up.
Oh.
Yeah. Now you understand. Yeah, okay. All right, so yeah, sorry. All right, so now we know that we have all the labels, it turns out. Instead of omega, we can just use J, and we have P mu and J3. So, in fact, we've got to something that looks very familiar, right? We know we can label a particle by its mass and its spin, its four momentum, and the third component of its spin. Okay, massless particles, slightly different. So now we have P mu as E naught naught E. We can't boost. They're travelling at the speed of light, of course, so we can't boost to their rest frame. So that's their four momentum. And okay, so it turns out, which we'll sort of motivate in a minute, that the Pauli-Lubyansky vector is proportional to this four momentum. And actually, what we're going to do now is just show that this thing is a helicity. In other words, it's the spin in the direction that the particle is going. So we consider consider the zeroth component of this equation. So lambda times E is 1/2 epsilon 0 I j k. Okay, this thing is equal to the three-dimensional epsilon tensor. And then 1/2 times epsilon ijk times mjk is just ji. So this thing is equal to ji pi. Okay, and of course, for this particle, E is the magnitude of the three momentum, and so lambda is j dot p over the magnitude of p, and that's exactly the spin in the direction that you're going. Okay, so lambda's the helicity, if this is true. And okay, so what you can do is you can calculate for this P mu, you can go off and calculate W mu, and what you'll find is that W0 is E times J3, W3 is minus E times J3. Okay, so far it's working, because this is exactly what we expect. Yeah?
Does it make a difference if it's J dot P or P dot J?
No. No. Okay, so we can imagine acting on a state and you get eigenvalues for both of those two things, right? So. And then those eigenvalues can be. All right. Now, there is a subtlety to do with W1 and W2. If you calculate them, you'll see that they come out to be some combination of boosts and J1s and J2s. They're set to zero, it turns out, for finite dimensional representations. So I don't want to go into that because it's an unnecessary complication, but this is the important fact. All right, so for massless representations, we know we can label them by their four momentum and their helicity. We no longer have, the mass is zero, so that's, We don't have to include that as a label. So if you wanted to, you could write C1 and C2, both of which are 0. But you might as well just write the helicity and the four momentum. So I should have pointed out that, okay, so you know that C1 is m squared, and C2, because it's w mu, so in general it's m squared times j squared. So for a massless rep, C2 is also 0. So the helicity is, again, from quantum mechanics. This is an integer in h-bar units, or half integer. And for massless representations, there's a subtlety, which is we have in Lorentz invariant quantum field theories, which are local, then there is a CPT symmetry. And for massless representations, when you act on this state with CPT, it gives you back a state with opposite helicity. This implies the existence of a state . Okay, so if we have a photon, for instance, that's a massless representation, helicity plus 1. You can do a CPT transformation on it, and it's got to also have a helicity minus 1 state. No helicity 0 state, though. Okay, for massive representations, they can be CPT self-conjugate. So you take a representation of a massive particle, you do a CPT transformation on it, and you get back the same thing. Essentially, what happens is you just swap these J3 components. J3 goes to minus J3, but each representation has all of the from minus J to J anyway, so it just maps onto itself. So later on, when we're working out what spins and helicities of massless supermultiplets are, you have to remember this fact, and remember that when you get some helicity, CPT implies for a massless supermultiplet that you have also the negative helicity states in there. Okay, good. So that's the Poincaré representations. So now we want to extend this to SUSY. So now, P mu commutes with the spin aureole generators. So we now add Q and Q bar to the Poincaré generators. And so C1, remember it's just P mu. That's still a Casimir, because if you look back at our commutation relations, P mu commutes with the Qs and the Q bars. Okay, so C1 is still going to commute with all the generators of the super Poincaré group. But actually, and it's a tutorial problem, C2, which is W mu, is not. So that's because W mu doesn't commute with Q alphas. Actually, you can see that from here because there's a non-trivial commutation relation between the M's and the Q's, and so this thing isn't going to commute. And actually, that's good. We know that W mu in massless and massive cases either describes the helicity or the spin. And we know that supersymmetry is going to change the helicity or the spin. So it better not commute. Otherwise, it wouldn't change the spin. So we can have different spins in the same multiplet. In fact, we'll have to. Well, remember, okay, so Casimirs, the labels of the Casimirs label all the elements of them. The facts, okay, so if you have a Casimir operator within one multiplet, the Casimir gives you the same eigenvalue for all of the different elements in the multiplet. Right? So that's why we're labeling a multiplet by the mass squared, because, you know, no matter whether there are different spins and stuff, the Casimir labels within that multiplet, they've all got the same mass squared. Okay, and that's because it commutes with all the symmetry generators. And the symmetry generators take you from one element of the multiplet to the other. So here we have something which is basically a couple of spins. And this doesn't commute with the super Poincaré algebra now. And that's because, you know, we're gonna have different spins in the same multiplet. Yeah, exactly. So the fact that this is a Casimir tells you that all the particles in a supermultiplet have to have the same mass. So this relates to what Cullen was saying last time. The fact that P mu commutes with Q alpha and Q bar tells you that particles of a different spin in the same supermultiplet have to have the same mass. Sorry? No. No. So, you know, when you build the minimal supersymmetric standard model, you have to break supersymmetry. Precisely because we don't see a scalar electron with the same mass as the electron. So, okay, we're going to get to this in the last lecture, I hope, or towards the end of the course. But, of course, that sounds a bit stupid, right? You introduce symmetry to break it. Yeah, that's true. I mean, you can still get... you don't break it in the completely general way, so you can still get some nice properties from doing that. Okay, but there is a Casimir which replaces this C2, and... the new Casimir of the super Poincaré algebra is called the superspin. C2 tilde. This is some horrendous looking thing where C mu nu defined as b mu minus p mu, oops, b mu, p mu, and b mu is w mu minus 1/4 bar alpha dot, sigma mu alpha dot beta. So this now, this horrendous thing now does commute with the Qs and Q bars and with all of the other super Poincaré generators. Okay, alright. I haven't, this is one of the few signs I haven't checked. If it's plus, okay. No, okay, I believe you. I've checked nearly all of the signs in these lectures, but that's one I haven't. Okay. So, right. We want to know now, in some Susy multiplet, so we kind of now have the feeling we're going to get different spins in the same multiplet, right? And actually, we can derive a relation between the number of bosons, Mb, and the number of fermions, Mf. And so we define this Witten index. It's actually Witten. So this is an operator which is going to help us do this. Define Witten index minus, which I'll write as minus 1 to the f. Okay, so that's the operator, minus 1 to the f. And basically, when the operator multiplies a bosonic state, acts on the bosonic state, we get the bosonic state back. But when it acts on a fermionic state, f, we get a minus sign. That's how it's defined. So, if you consider anti-commuting it with one of the Qs or a Q bar, you get zero. Because since, say for example, minus to the F Q alpha. So we act on, we can imagine acting on either a boson or a fermion. With this anti-commutator, and in either case you'll get a zero. Okay, so I'll just do one of them for you. So if we act on a boson with the anti-commutator, okay, so Q alpha acting on a boson gives us some fermion. Right, and then minus F acting on the fermion gives us minus some fermion. Minus 1 to the F acting on the boson just gives us plus a boson, Q alpha on it. Gives us a fermion. Okay, and then you can check it. It's the same thing with fermions. Okay, if you act without it on this thing, with this thing on either bosons or fermions, you get zero. So, if we imagine doing a trace across the elements of our supermultiplet, so we sum, basically, across the elements of a supermultiplet of minus the Witten index times Q alpha Q bar beta dot, So we can just write this out more explicitly. So in this first term, we just use the fact that the anticommutator is zero, so if we call that star, we get and now in the second term, we just use the cyclic property of the trace and move the Q alpha over there. Okay, so we've got zero. So we know that this peculiar trace is zero. But we know what the anticommutator is. So we can actually just substitute that into the left-hand side now. Okay, and then this thing, these are just C numbers as far as this operator trace is concerned. So they can be pulled out the front. And so we know that the trace over a supermultiplet of the Witten index is zero. Just pull these out the front. Okay, so so that means, so the left-hand side is we sum over all the states in the supermultiplet. So and sandwich. This is what the operator trace means. So we sandwich over all the states. So we have bosonic and fermionic states. Fermions F, bosons B, fermions F. Okay, so this thing is just sum B minus sum F. Okay, so each one of these brackets is normalized to 1. And so this sum is just equal to the number of bosons, and this sum is equal to the number of fermions in the supermultiplet. So there's a nice result. So we know in our supermultiplet the number of fermions must be equal to the number of bosons. So I think we've just got time to calculate the states in a massless supermultiplet. Now, So we know what our form momentum looks like for the massless guy. And so C1 is 0. And actually, if you calculate the superspin, this C2 twiddle, you'll get 0 too, turns out. So now, when we're calculating, you know, the spins of particles in supermultiplets, you always use the anticommutator between Q and Q bar, because these are the things that are going to change the spin to the states. So now I just substitute in explicitly for P mu. Imagine acting on some states with this thing. And I substitute in explicitly for the sigma matrices as well. We're going to get twice E sigma 0 minus sigma 3. Okay, depending on alpha and beta dot, this is a 2 by 2 matrix. So this 2 by 2 matrix looks like 0, 0, 0, 1. Yeah.
So since our two Casimir operators both have eigenvalues 0, does that mean that all the massless particles in the theory have to be in the same multiple?
No. No, it doesn't actually. Yeah, that's strange. We're going to see now that we do get different supermultiplets. The label, yeah, so we're missing a label, right? Okay. Let me think about that, because that is strange. I agree. I wonder if... maybe I've got this second Casimir wrong. Maybe that's not zero. I think maybe the superspin's not zero. Yeah. Let me just check that. Callum, do you...
No, I think it is.
It is zero. So that's strange, right? Because we do definitely get... there's something at the back. Yeah. The sigma, yeah. But the trace, that's right. So, so this lives in an SU2 cross SU2 space. But this trace is over a different space. It's over the. This trace is defined actually in this way. It's you sandwich the operator in the middle by all of the states that you have in the supermultiplet. So that's the definition of this operator trace. So I could still write here, you know, put in 2 sigma mu p mu's in here, but the p mu is going to act on the state just to give a number. Sigma mu, well, although it's a matrix, I mean, it's still a number which I can just bring out the left-hand side. Yeah, have you worked out? I don't know what's going on there. Yeah, exactly. That's what I think we're missing.
Yeah.
What happens is that the maximum helicity is going to label the different supermultiplets.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Is there a maximum helicity operator?
I don't know. I mean, the helicity operator is a Poincaré operator, not a super Poincaré one, right? Yeah, this is why I'm not sure about this. Yeah, I don't know. I need to think about that. I'll set it as a tutorial. Was there another question? No. Okay. We'll see anyway. We'll see how we build up the representations. Okay, so like if we take these guys equal to both alpha and beta dot, if we take them equal to 1, we get this left-hand thing, so that they're Q1, Q bar 1 dot is 0. So I can this means, you know, I can sandwich this in between some state, massless state. Okay, so in other words, this thing is 0, right? So Q1 bar dot annihilates the state. Okay, and also, but Q2 doesn't. Okay, it does something. It's non-zero. Q2 dot. So, and we have Q2 dot is 4e. Okay. And remember how to get the upstairs index ones. So, in terms of the upstairs index, you have a non-zero 1 dot because it's minus Q2 dot. So that's just, remember, you've got to worry about whether it's upstairs or downstairs. Yeah. Well, that's an intermediate step. Okay, so we have both of those terms, and both of them are actually equal to, mod squared of Q1 dot bar acting on P mu lambda. Right? So really, you get this equals 0. You got the answer. Okay. This is super helicity.
Yeah.
Okay. That's which book was that from?
This blue one.
Who? Yeah, who wrote it?
Bookbinder and Kuchenko. Ideas meant to Susie and Supergraphy.
Okay, good. Yeah. That's something that's. I haven't seen it in books before. That's good.
Yeah, it's quite
a. I see. So does that mean we have to add an extra Casimir for the super?
So that one vanishes, so it doesn't tell you anything. But simplicity is in much of this case is a Casimir instead.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Just for those representations. Okay. Yeah. So both things imply that this is zero, right? Q1 dot annihilates the state with the 1 dot downstairs. So I've used implicitly here, I've used that, you know, Q bar 1 dot, the complex conjugate of that is Q1, right? Okay, good. So, so if we use from the previous commutation relation, between, so that's the one between M rho sigma and Q. We can work out the commutation relation of the Pauli-Lubyansky vector and Q bar. So P mu commutes with Q bar, but M rho sigma doesn't. And we just substitute in this commutator that we found last lecture. Okay. Now we substitute in for sigma bar, rho sigma, and we substitute in for our p nu's, okay. So this sigma bar j is equal to minus sigma j. So we just get minus sigma j. And then we use the commutation relation between two Pauli matrices, which is plus I plus 2i. Not 3jk. So we get plus 2i times epsilon jkl sigma l. Cuba. Okay, so this thing, you now have to worry about the contraction of these two epsilon tensors. It's going to give us something proportional to delta 3L. Okay, there'll be a factor of 2 because we can switch the indices J and K. So it's going to be 1, 2 plus 2, 1. And the only other thing you have to worry about is the sign, and the sign is minus. Turns out, so this is minus E over 2 times sigma 3 Q bar. Okay, so this commutator. W0 acting on I've taken the mu equals 0 component from it because I put a 0 in there. So that's what we have. So we're messing about with W's and Q's in order to get from one spin to another in the state, one helicity to another. So if we imagine acting on some state with W0 Q 1 dot bar, okay, Now we know what this commutator is from the left-hand board. And so we just substitute in, it gives us minus a half there, times P0 Q bar 1 dot. And lambda. And remember, W0 gives us back the helicity times P0. So what we've seen here is that when we act on a state with a Q1 bar, it lowers the helicity by half a unit. Q1 dot bar lowers helicity by half a unit. So this thing, of course, with a minus sign is just equal to Q2 dot bar with index downstairs . So some states with the helicity lowered by half is proportional to this Q2 dot bar state. I've divided by root 4e because that will allow us to keep the state normalization. So this is a normalization factor. Okay, there are no other states in our supermultiplet. Okay, so we can act on the state to get helicity differing by a half, but there are no other states. We know that because Q1 dot with the index downstairs just always gives a zero on massless states, okay, from this argument, and Q2 dot acting on this new state we've constructed is proportional to Q2 dot times Q2 dot, well, equals, okay, Q2 dot bar acting on this state. And these are anti-commuting objects. So when you have the product of any two of them, it's got to be zero. So that's very good. So we now have found our supermultiplet. With a state, massless supermultiplet, we just have two states, one with helicity lambda, one with helicity lambda minus a half. They've got the same, well, they're both massless, so they have the same mass in this case. And the only other operator you might worry about is Q2. So imagine we act on our new state with Q2. So that's Q2 dot R over root 4e. Lambda. So that's equal to the anti-commutator minus Q bar Q. So this one is zero because Q2 annihilates the state. So we just get back to our, to the original state, right, using Q2. So it's our original. Yeah. Yeah, I've realised I've missed a step in the logic. So we, what I should have said right at the start of this was we pick P lambda such that Q alpha acting on it. So we pick some state such that the Qs without bars annihilate it, right? And we know we can do that because if not, we define some P lambda prime, which is just defined as Q times the original state. Okay. And then now Q alpha acting on this guy gives us zero because you've got the product of two Q alphas. Okay, so we can define P lambda by that, P comma lambda by that criterion. And that's something that I missed. But, okay. And so we've just defined this one that Q2 and Q1 annihilate it. So what we see is that, Q2 dot takes us one way with the helicity, adds, takes away half a unit, and Q2 adds half a unit. And we get back to the same states. Okay, we're over time, so I'd better stop. But just to point out that, of course, now this means that we've got one boson, and one fermion. And so this illustrates what we proved with the Witten index. The number of bosons is equal to the number of fermions. Okay, because you know, whatever lambda is, if lambda is 1, then we've also got a lambda of a half in the same supermultiplet. Yeah.
And what's the case here with one boson and fermion? It's the case where Q annihilates the state?
No, what we've proved is that we have P and lambda, and we've got P and lambda minus a half in the supermultiplet, okay? And there's nothing else. That's what we proved. There's nothing else because we just... The only things we can operate with to change the spins are these guys, right? The Q, Q, Q bars. And Q2 dot takes you in this, Q dot bar takes you in this direction. Q2 takes you in that, back to the original state. The Q1s annihilate the states, and you know, that's all there is.
Is it defined so that the Q1s annihilate
them? Yeah, because of this. We've defined the P lambda state such that the Q1 and Q2 annihilates it. Yeah. Okay, well, at the start of next time, I'll give you examples of how they're supposed to be in nature in the MSSM. You know. We'll see that next time. Yeah.